Okay, so are you ready to explore the Tree of Life? And no, not the Christmas kind.
Oh.
We're diving into these amazing biology textbook excerpts today, all about the just incredible diversity of life on Earth.
I know, it's really incredible to think about, like, how did we go from like a lion being this symbol of courage to realizing it's just one tiny part of this giant web of life?
Now, and we're talking about millions of species here. This textbook says scientists have already identified something like 1.5 million, but then they think there are probably way more out there that we haven't even discovered yet.
Oh yeah, definitely.
But before we get ahead of ourselves, let's go back in time for a second. Imagine opening up one of those old medieval
Oh
bestiaries.
yeah, those are so cool. Just imagine like all these fantastical creatures mixed in with real animals, and every single one represents like some moral lesson or something. Talk about a human-centered way of looking at nature.
It's true. It's like, beware of the dragon's greed, or be like the unicorn, pure and perfect. It's wild when you think about how much our understanding has changed, you know?
Surely.
Back then, every single plant and animal had this purpose that related back to us. But then, as people started exploring and discovering all these new species, that idea just kind of fell apart. I mean, what's the big moral lesson from a panda bear? Cuteness.
Right, and the discovery of all these new and seemingly purposeless organisms really challenged these old ways of thinking. Like, what is the point of that? And then there's the, the darker side of nature that these bestiaries kind of skipped over.
Oh yeah, nature can be brutal. The textbook section on parasites, I mean, that zombie ant fungus is the stuff of nightmares.
Oh, tell me about it.
Talk about a hostile takeover.
It's a perfect example of how natural selection can create these super complex and, yeah, sometimes pretty scary relationships.
Yeah.
Like the fungus has basically figured out how to hijack the ant's brain so it can
Rah.
survive.
Oh no. What?
And that picture of the ant exploding so the fungus can release its spores, like that's enough to make anyone think twice about going for a hike in the woods.
Yeah, seriously. Okay, so we've got incredible diversity, sometimes with these kind of unsettling survival strategies. But here's where it gets really, really interesting. When scientists really started looking closely, they noticed all these unbelievable similarities between organisms that seemed totally unrelated. There's this amazing picture in here, a human skeleton right next to a bird skeleton from 1555. So even back then, people were struck by that, by how similar they look.
Yeah, and it's a powerful image, isn't it? It makes you really think differently about how special humans actually are. And it's not even just birds. Compare a dugong, which is this marine mammal, to a European mole, which, lives its entire life underground. And you see the same basic skeleton just completely changed and tweaked for their different lifestyles.
Right, and that's what blows my mind. It's like evolution was given this one set of building blocks and told, okay, now make a fish, make a bird, make a human. It just makes you wonder how much of life's diversity is really just these tiny tweaks to that same basic blueprint.
And that's what fascinated scientists like Carl Linnaeus. He took all those shared traits, and he created that hierarchical classification system. It's like building a family tree, but for every living thing on Earth, with species and then genera and then families and all of that.
Like organizing this chaotic family reunion. You go over there by the potato salad, you're with the fungi. But here's the thing. As brilliant as Linnaeus' system was, it didn't actually explain why all those similarities were there. It was like describing this tree, all the different branches, without ever actually explaining how it grew in the first place. We knew things were related, but we didn't know why. And that why is really the most important part,
Yeah,
right?
for sure. You need the why.
Okay, so we've got this awesome system for categorizing life, but we're still missing the instruction manual. And then this textbook throws us another curveball. Defining what a species actually is way more complicated than I thought.
Oh, it definitely gets messy. A species, especially when you're talking about sexually reproducing organisms, can be really hard to pin down. We like our categories nice and neat, but nature doesn't always cooperate. Like, look at all the variations you can have within just one species. Think about sexual dimorphism.
Oh, yeah. Like with those spiders, where the female is gigantic and the male is this tiny little dude who's just hoping she doesn't eat him for dinner. You'd never guess they were the same species just from looking at them. Or ducks. The male is so fancy and colorful and showing off, and the female's all camouflaged. It makes you wonder how many times scientists thought they'd found a brand new species when really it was just a male and a female of the same one.
I know, right? It just goes to show how tricky it can be to draw those clear lines in nature. And then there are all the microbes, which often reproduce asexually. That's a whole other level of complexity.
So it's like we're trying to organize life on Earth, but the pieces of the puzzle keep changing shape on us.
It really does show how much of classification is about trying to make sense of this wild, messy thing we call nature.
Right.
We love our neat categories, but nature often has other plans. Like a species, especially for those organisms that reproduce sexually, it's really more like this fluid group that's always changing rather than this fixed category.
That makes sense, yeah.
Mm.
But when you start moving up to those bigger classifications like genera and families and orders, it feels like we're just drawing bigger and bigger circles around groups that are already kind of blurry. Like it's more about making it easier for us to understand than about any real biological rules.
It's a lot like when you try to organize a library, right? You have to come up with all these categories and subcategories just to try and wrap your head around how much stuff there is. But the lines between different genres, they can get really fuzzy. This textbook uses bears as an example. So you've got the Ursus genus, which includes like brown bears and polar bears, and they're all super similar, right? But then you've got these other animals, like the spectacled bear or the giant panda, that are kind of bear-like, but they're different enough that they get put into their own separate genera.
So it's like grizzly bears and polar bears, they're like siblings, you know, they've got that family resemblance, but pandas are more like that distant cousin who shows up at the family reunion wearing a monocle, and everyone's like, wait, who is that?
Exactly. And it just makes you wonder, like, how much of classification is really based on clear biological differences and how much of it is really just like scientists making judgment calls, you know?
Yeah.
And this is where evolution swoops in and gives us that aha moment where it all starts to click.
Okay, lay it on me. I am ready for this aha moment.
So all those similarities that we see across different species, they're not random. They're actually evidence of shared ancestry.
Okay.
Evolution is this incredible thread connecting every single living thing on Earth. It creates this beautiful, intricate web, the tree of life.
Okay, I mean, intuitively, that makes sense.
Right.
But how does it actually work, you know? Hmm. We've got Linnaeus's system grouping organisms based on shared traits, but we still need a way to explain how those traits got to be so similar in the first place.
Right, and the answer is the amazing process of evolution by natural selection.
Okay.
This is what explains how those shared traits, what we call synapomorphies, actually develop, like all mammals have hair, and they have mammary glands. Those shared traits tell us that they're all part of the same branch on the tree of life. And the closer any two species are on the tree, the more recently they shared a common ancestor. So naturally, they're going to have more of those synapomorphies in common.
So it's kind of like tracing those little family resemblances back through generations. But instead of just one family, we're talking about like all of life on Earth.
Exactly. And get this. This whole idea of shared ancestry, it's not just about explaining things we already know. It can actually help us predict what we might find, like in the fossil record.
Hold on a second. So we're not just using evolution to look back in time. We can use it to make guesses about what we haven't even discovered yet.
Exactly.
That is wild.
Because if evolution is true, then the fossil record should show this clear progression, with the simplest organisms appearing way earlier on and then the more complex ones evolving later. And it shouldn't just be this totally random jumble of fossils. They should fit into the branches of that tree of life, even if those branches represent lineages that are extinct now.
So you're saying that even extinct organisms should fit into the same family tree as the ones alive today, even if they look totally different from anything alive right now?
Yes.
It's like finding this super old dusty photo album and you realize that that guy in the back with the crazy hat and the mutton chops, he's your great-great-granduncle or something. You wouldn't create a whole separate photo album just for him, right? He's still part of the family.
Exactly. And even though the fossil record is super incomplete, I mean, we've really only found a tiny, tiny fraction of all the different organisms that have ever lived. Everything we have found lines up perfectly with the predictions of evolutionary theory. It's amazing.
Okay, can you give me an example? Like, what's a good example of one of those weird relatives in the fossil record that really proves this point?
How about dinosaurs?
Dinosaurs, okay.
Because they're not just giant lizards that died out. They're actually much more closely related to birds than they are to any other reptiles.
Wait, really? Dinosaurs and birds?
Mm-hmm.
That seems like a bit of a stretch. How can scientists be so sure about that? What's the evidence?
Remember those synapomorphies we were talking about?
Yeah.
Well, paleontologists have found tons and tons of fossils that show this super clear progression from those early dinosaur-like ancestors to the birds we see today. We're talking feathers, hollow bones, similar hip structures. Even their wrists are similar. It's all right there in the bones. They've got this whole bunch of shared traits that just scream common ancestor.
See, that's so cool. I love stuff like that. So all those birds we see flying around today, they're descended from dinosaurs.
Yep.
It really makes you think about just how much time is involved in evolution. You know, we're talking millions and millions of years.
And it really shows how evolutionary theory isn't just about explaining what we already know. It can help us make predictions about things we haven't even discovered yet. The discovery of Tiktaalik is the perfect example of that.
Tiktaalik. Okay, that does sound familiar, but I can't quite place it. Remind me what that is again.
Oh, Tiktaalik is incredible. It's the perfect example of how powerful evolution is as a predictive tool. Scientists used evolutionary theory, and they predicted that the ancestor of all land, vertebrates, amphibians, reptiles, mammals, even us, they said it would look like a fish with leg-like fins.
So they were picturing this fishapod, this missing link between the water and the land, before they even found it.
Exactly.
That's so wild.
And based on the fossil record of fish and early tetrapods, those very first land vertebrates, they figured out roughly when and where they should look for a creature like this. And then guess what? They found it.
Seriously? They predicted this missing link and then they went out and found it. That's amazing.
It was a huge discovery. You're right. Tiktaalik had gills and scales like a fish, but it also had this flexible neck, strong ribs, and this is the coolest part, it had fins with bones that looked just like the limbs of animals that live on land. It was the perfect transitional fossil, just a perfect snapshot of evolution in action.
This is blowing my mind, I gotta be honest. We've gone from medieval bestiaries to zombie ants, dinosaur birds, and now fishapods. It's been quite a trip.
I know, right?
But we've talked a lot about the results of evolution.
Right.
What about the process itself? I'm still not totally clear on how it all works, like what drives these incredible changes we're talking about.
Sure. You're right. We should definitely talk about that. So at the heart of it all is natural selection. This is the engine of evolutionary change. And two guys, Charles Darwin and Alfred Russel Wallace, they both figured this out independently, which is wild. And they both deserve credit for that. They're the ones who really developed this theory.
Right. Natural selection. It's a phrase everyone's heard, but people often simplify it to survival of the fittest, which, I mean, yeah, it sounds cool, but I have a feeling it's way more complicated than that.
Yeah, you're right. Survival of the fittest does kind of make it sound like some kind of reality show where animals compete in these crazy obstacle courses. And it definitely sounds cool, but what does it actually mean in practice?
Yeah, it's definitely a phrase that gets thrown around a lot,
yeah.
And it leads to a lot of misunderstanding, too. Because natural selection isn't really about being the strongest or the fastest or anything like that. It's about reproductive success.
Mm.
It's about passing on those genes, the ones that give you an advantage, to the next generation.
Okay, so it's not just about living a long time and having a ton of babies. There's more to it. There's always more to it. It's kind of like investing, you know? But instead of investing money, you're investing your genes. You could have a ton of offspring, but if none of them survive long enough to reproduce, then your investment, from a genetic standpoint at least, hasn't really paid off.
Okay. So it's about quality over quantity. Like, you don't want to put all your eggs in one basket, especially if that basket's got holes in it or something.
Exactly. And this textbook, it does a really good job of highlighting some of the things that can affect an organism's reproductive success. One is having access to mates, which, I mean, yeah, obviously, right. But think about what that actually involves. You've got to find a mate, then you have to attract them, and then you've got to outcompete all your rivals, too.
It's like that old saying, it takes two to tango.
Yeah,
right?
Right.
It doesn't matter if you've got amazing survival skills. You know, if you can't find a dance partner, then those genes aren't making it to the next round.
Exactly. Then there's the whole challenge of staying alive long enough to reproduce in the first place. I mean, you could be the best dancer out there, but if you're always getting eaten by predators or you get sick and die young, then your genetic contribution's over before it even really begins.
So it's like running this crazy obstacle course, dodging all these dangers just to get a chance to even get to the mating dance.
Exactly. And then you need resources, too. I mean, you need food, you need water, you need shelter. All of that is essential for survival. And in the end, that's what's going to determine your reproductive success. Any adaptation that helps an organism get those resources more effectively, well, that's going to give them a serious leg up on the competition.
Yeah, that makes total sense. Like, maybe you've got this longer beak so you can reach deeper into flowers to get the nectar. Or maybe you've got these super strong claws to help you catch prey. It's all about having the right tools for the job.
And then there's cooperation, which you might not think would be that important in a system that's all about competition, but it is. Like, think about those worker ants we talked about earlier. They don't reproduce at all. They're totally focused on supporting the colony. So how does that fit into this whole reproductive success thing?
That's a really good point. It's like they're giving up their own genetic legacy so the group as a whole can succeed.
Exactly. And this gets into a super interesting aspect of evolution called kin selection. Because even though those worker ants aren't reproducing directly by helping the colony survive, they're indirectly making sure that their genes are passed down. Because they share a lot of the same genes as the queen.
Oh, I see. So it's kind of like investing in your extended family.
Yeah.
Their success is your success too, genetically speaking, because you're all related.
Exactly. And it just shows you how natural selection works on so many different levels. It's not just looking at one trait in isolation. It's looking at the whole package. Everything about an organism, from its physical characteristics to its behaviors, all of it works together to increase its chances of passing down those genes. And we call that whole package the phenotype, right?
Okay, got it.
But remember, the genotype, that's like the underlying genetic blueprint. The phenotype is how those genes actually show up in the real world.
Okay, that makes sense.
Huh.
But this textbook doesn't just talk about natural selection in the wild. It also talks a lot about domestication, which feels kind of like a totally different topic to me. What's the connection there?
Yeah, it might seem like a bit of a sidetrack, but domestication is actually a great way to understand natural selection. Like, think about all the different dog breeds we have today. Everything from Chihuahuas, which are tiny, to Great Danes, which are, well, huge, and they all came from wolves. But through selective breeding, humans have dramatically changed those traits over a surprisingly short amount of time.
I know, it's crazy. A Chihuahua and a Great Dane practically look like they're from different planets. But they can still technically have puppies together. Talk about an awkward family reunion.
I know, right? But it shows just how powerful selection can be, even when humans are the ones in control, instead of nature. And you can see the same thing with crops, like corn. Thousands of years of selective breeding, starting with wild grasses, and look what we have now. These high-yielding, super nutritious varieties of corn that we eat all the time.
It's kind of wild to think about. Humans have accidentally become these evolutionary engineers, you know, shaping the traits of plants and animals to get what we need and want.
We have. We really have. And the important thing to remember here is that both natural and artificial selection, they both need something to work with. They need a variation in those traits, and those traits have to be heritable, which means they're encoded in the organism's DNA. That's the only way those traits can be passed down and amplified across generations.
So you're saying you can't just breed a super fast racehorse if speed isn't already a thing that varies within horses?
Yeah. Right.
You need those genes to already be in the mix somewhere. You need that raw material before selection can work its magic, whether it's natural or artificial.
Exactly. And to wrap things up, here's something interesting to think about. Think about a Chihuahua, this tiny little dog that's always shivering, that's entirely a product of artificial selection. It exists because we think they're cute, but a Chihuahua would never survive in the wild, not without us to take care of it. So what does that tell us about these selection pressures and how sometimes they're totally random and kind of arbitrary?
That is such a good question. And it really highlights how evolution isn't really about reaching some kind of perfect final form. It's just about adapting to whatever pressures you're facing, whether it's a changing climate, a new predator to watch out for, or, you know, in the case of the Chihuahua, a nice warm lap and a never-ending supply of food. Well, we covered some serious ground today, from ancient bee series with unicorns to zombie ants, fishopods, and the mind-blowing power of natural selection. It's been amazing.
I know, right?
I feel like we've just scratched the surface, though.
We have. There's so much more to explore. But I hope this deep dive has given you a new appreciation for evolution, because it's pretty amazing when you think about it. It's elegant, it's beautiful, and it's happening all the time, all around us. It's shaping the world we live in, and it's shaping us, too.
I love that.
Yeah.
And on that note, we'll leave you with one last thing to ponder. What if we discovered life on another planet? Like, what if we found aliens? Would those alien life forms fit into our Earth-based tree of life? Or would we need to create a whole new system to classify them? It really makes you think just how universal are these evolutionary processes that we've been talking about. Until next time, keep exploring, keep asking those big questions, and keep diving deep.